Books with Aaron, Polly, and Wayne. I'm Aaron.
This is Paul.
And this is Wayne.
Guys, I'm going to apologize on the upfront. The wife is out of town, and she normally has custody of the dogs while I'm recording. And I've got all three of them here in my office with me this morning. So you may hear some dog sounds today.
Shucky.
Already, Flip is over here trying to figure out why I'm talking to the computer. So
you know, that's the funny part is, like, my dogs will be perfectly fine. But if I am on a call with someone and I'm actually talking and not talking to them, they get so confused and they want to be on me.
Well, it's funny is that, you know, while we were doing the show prep, everybody was on the floor sound asleep. The minute we started the show, here comes Flip and he's like, hey, what's going on over here? Can I be on?
Well, it's probably because you just went, hello and welcome to Funny Books.
Probably. But, you know, he knows that DJ Kitty has gotten to be on a couple of times. Why not DJ Flip?
DJ Flip.
Yeah.
I think he's MC Flip.
MC 900 Foot Flip. So you got to hear him. So
yeah. See, there he goes. Guest appearance by MC Flip.
So Wayne was just regaling us with his tale of a trip to Ross, which resulted in a couple of purchases. Wayne, you want to tell our friends about it?
Yeah. So I go to Ross a lot to try to find cheap Transformers. But I'm in the aisle. I look over and there is a Batman Beyond replica battery. The Mika ones. And I look behind it, and there's another one that's a different Batman Beyond one. And then there's the Adam West Batarang as well. So I grab all three of them. These things are normally $30 online. I get them each for $9.99. It's funny. I'm in the checkout line, too, and there's this little kid behind me, and he looks up at his dad and he goes, that man's spending all of his money on toys.
Yes, he is. Well, so you'll be fighting for justice now. You'll be out in the streets bringing in the bad guys. Is that what we can expect? And who's first on your rogues gallery that you're bringing in, Wayne?
I think Andrew.
Ah, good. In fact, maybe you've already taken down Andrew, and that's why he's not here today. Or is he just not here today because he fears your justice?
Well, I can't say for sure because that might incriminate me.
Well, you know, or is Andrew just late like he does? And we'll randomly hear his voice 30 minutes into the podcast.
Possibly. That is on brand.
Yes.
So, Paul.
Yes, sir.
Dutton Ranch.
Yes.
I am on record as saying that I very much like this show, and I do. However, there were major Godfather 3 vibes in the season finale where, you know, Beth and Rip become aware of the nefarious hijinks that their business partners are involved in. Mm-hmm. And instead of doing what, you know, normal people would do, like informing authorities. And, you know, I know people will make the argument, well, you know, you can't inform the sheriff because they know that the sheriff is in, you know, the bad guy's back pocket. But, you know, it's a federal crime that we're talking about. You know, there are feds you could involve. No, they just immediately start taking the law into their own hands. And I get it. You know, we know that they are very much law into their own hands kinds of people from Yellowstone. But they very much go into, you know, Godfather 3 mode and just start talking like, we may not have enough time to save this Pope. oh my God. It was such a huge leap. And at no point in the writing did they make the case for it. You were just supposed to accept that this is a choice that normal human beings would make.
Well, you know that they make those choices, right? That's the reason we watch Yellowstone and Dutton Ranch is because Rip and Beth take the law into their own hands. Like, for what it's worth, they were sold a cow that, you know, gave
had
diseases.
Hoof and foot.
Yeah. Had hoof and foot and gave it to the rest of their cattle. And so they had to kill all their cattle. Didn't turn the guy into the authorities. Just went and beat the shit out of him. Right? So, like, this is what they do. So I'm not surprised. You know, I will say, you know, I think Dutton Ranch has been pretty solid. I would not say it's the level of great Yellowstone. It was the level of good Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the season finale hit with a bit of a thud for me, in that it just kind of felt like it ended, but without really resolve. It kind of felt like the season wasn't over, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably, you even asked me before we started podcasting, was this the season finale? And yeah, because it doesn't really feel like a season finale. It just kind of feels like, if anything, this feels like the rising tension rather than the, you know, the actual you know, conflict resolution.
Yeah, it feels less cliffhanger and more like, you know, we'll be back after these messages.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's what I was like. I was like, oh man, when it ended last week when I watched it, I was like, fuck, I gotta wait a whole week. No. You've got much longer to wait. Yes. You know,
but they're already filming, at least, so you don't have to wait like 3 years like
true shows. But the cliffhanger ending, you know, is their adopted son, I'm going to throw adopted up in air quotes, gets, you know, taken by the cartel. And yeah, that's a suspenseful cliffhanger, but it just, because they spent the entire episode looking for him, you know, it bugged me that like you said, you know, it was less a cliffhanger and more, you know, just not finished. And and particularly in that it was only a 9-episode season, and I'm just so used to 8 or 10, you know. So, I mean, I just assumed that there was another episode. And the previews that I saw never said season finale. So it just feels like they ran out of film.
Yeah. You know, I'm torn, because it also feels like it could have been 8 episodes. Like, it feels like this season may have been an episode long.
You could have cut episode, you know, 3 out, I'm sure. You know, I mean, there was some legginess early on. Not awful, not like some of the other shows that they've done. Not like Tulsa King, for crying out loud. But you know, there was some legginess there. But I gotta say, overall, really enjoyed the season. I just really object to the season ender, because I felt like they should have gotten to a better resolution, you know, and still giving us a cliffhanger, like, you know, there's a gunshot at the end, and oh my gosh, did somebody die? That's the kind of cliffhanger I want, not like, oh God, we're gonna have to continue the search for Carter into the next season, even though we spent an entire episode driving randomly around town looking for Carter.
Yeah, you know, in 2026, I feel it odd. Now, obviously, I'm not a parent, but I find it odd that anyone would literally just drive aimlessly around town looking for their child.
Why you wouldn't have Find My Phone on?
Yeah.
You know?
You know, and don't get me wrong, Carter, and you know, unfortunately,
he's 19. Yeah.
He's 19. You know, and it's also one of these things that this season largely found ways to turn Carter into the token teenager that you hate.
Uh-huh.
You know, the rebellious teenager who keeps running away from home and quit school and got a girlfriend who's a bitch and, you know, and disrupted their work party and, like, you know, and stupid stuff like that. Like, you know, unfortunately, they've turned Carter into the kid that I'm like, just kill him. Like,
yeah.
Just let the cartel have him. You've taken away their control.
Yeah.
We don't like that kid anyway. You can have him. You know, and I hate that. You know, I hate that. You know, I mean, Carter, I mean, don't get me wrong, the character has not been the greatest character in the history of character development to begin with. But, you know, I do feel like in Yellowstone, he had a bit more of a purpose than just, here's the teenage son that's annoying. And I feel like, unfortunately, they've turned him into that a little bit in this show.
And I hate that they've turned him into that, given his background. You know, he's turned into typical ungrateful son of a bitch.
Yeah.
And, you know, here he should be the most grateful, because, you know, he was literally carried out of a stall and brought into the house. You know, he was sleeping in the stable, literally, you know, rescued from the horses to come live as part of this family and learn a trade and, you know, have a connection that he'd never have otherwise. And I don't understand, you know, he was at an age when that happened that he should value it more than he does. And, I think that teenage rebellion that you typically see is generally from kids who've, never known that kind of hardship, right? And so I find it super frustrating that they dove him into that. I'm also frustrated with some of the other storylines on the show. Like, I can't figure out his girlfriend, because one minute she's cheering on her father taking on the reins of the ranch, and then, the next moment she's, she doesn't trust him, and there's this unevenness about how she feels about her dad. I find that weird.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely find that character.
Rob Will, by the way.
Rob Will.
That's her dad. Yeah.
Yeah. I find that the, his daughter, Rob Will's daughter, whose name I don't remember off the top of my head.
Ariana,
that sounds about
something
right.
Like
Adriana,
that. Yeah.
Maybe Adriana. Yeah. I found her character frustrating. Cause like, in one episode she'll go out of her way to be kind and loving to Carter.
Uh-huh.
And in the next episode, she's basically, cucking him.
Yeah. And I didn't understand what she was doing at the party. I mean, I was so what's going on here? You've completely changed tone. And I get, girls that age can be mercurial. But at no point did they explain why she, to your point, cucked him. I don't understand that.
I will say that's one thing that I'm finding a little bit frustrating about Dutton Ranch is I don't know that they've quite developed an understanding of the characters. So they're writing... The characters will change depending on what the story needs them to be in that moment.
That's right. It's like everything moves at the speed of story, right? The characters have no true characterization. They just respond to whatever the story needs at that moment.
Yeah, like Annette Bening's character, right? Yeah. You find out, the history of her, her baby daddy, and that relationship. But all of a sudden she's judgmental of Rob Will and what's happening on. So, it doesn't quite, they haven't quite really figured out who these characters are, I would say. And I know I'm doing a lot of complaining. Overall, I thought Dutton Ranch was a pretty solid first season. It is not, it feels very much like the sixth season of Yellowstone. It definitely, in my mind, it needs, I'm trying to figure out the right, I don't quite yet care enough about these characters other than the fact that I know these characters from something I did care about them in, which was Yellowstone, right.
And I think what the show really needs, because the talent is there, you've got some terrific actors on the screen, right? I mean, I just I think I love every single actor on the screen.
Yeah,
what I'm having a hard time with is that there's no writing discipline in the room.
And as we said,
everything moves at the speed of story. Characters, are not consistent. And I get it. Nobody is just one thing. For instance, Andrew is a villain. We all know this, right?
Yeah.
But he also has some good qualities. But we understand those, right? But you at no point do you understand why some of these characters are doing what they're doing. And it's not part of a larger mystery. It's just random shit these characters do to move on to the next story.
What they need to
do
for the story, exactly. Yeah. And nothing is more frustrating in the show than Ed Harris, for me, because Ed Harris is a brilliant actor. Brilliant actor. And you hire him to play the most even-tempered, calm dude in the world when his shtick is literally passion and yelling.
And yet, he pulls up right as the cartel is about to invade the ranch, right? And just cavalierly picks up a rifle and starts shooting cartel guys.
Yeah, and it's like, hold on. I thought he was a vet.
Yeah.
With a history?
Well, he's got a military background because he talked about his service, right? So, okay, I get it. You're combat trained from 40 years ago, but it just cracks me up like, oh, yeah, this is what we do. We just, instead of get the fuck off the ranch, right?
We just shoot people.
Call the authorities. No, we shoot these guys. Because that's what vets do in Texas, by God.
Yeah. He it wasn't a horse. He would have saved the horse.
Well, you know, this it's the difference between, you know, a dog and cat vet versus a large animal vet. You know, that you got to go to a large animal vet if you expect him to handle any firearms.
Yeah, so, exactly. If you need him to shoot some drug, some cartel on your ranch, go to the horse vet. Yeah, I was like, wait, what? Like, you know, like he has spent his, you know, this entire, like even the ranch hand, the main ranch hand, who works for Rip, whose name.
Oh, again, Azul.
Yeah. You know, like all these characters are like gentle and kind, you know, they're caring, right? You know,
but they will straight up murder you and dump you in a hole.
Straight up murder you without any question, right? Like, you know, with it's like, where does this loyalty come from, right? It's not like the town.
Do you feel like when Beth and Rip were shopping for property that, you know, the first thing they had to do is look around like, okay, where are we going to dump our bodies? You know, we had that great big, you know, ravine that we could dump the bodies in Montana. Where are we going to dump the bodies here? Oh, look, we found this great big well.
Yeah.
This abandoned well. Where's the Texas
train station? That well is going to be smelling.
I mean, at what point does it just fill up? You know, where the bodies are just poking out over the top of the hole. I mean, because they dumped a lot of bodies down there this week. So
they did. Quite a few.
Okay. So Mariano, who is Joaquin's father, right?
Yes.
Which is Annette Bening's sort of adopted son, right?
Yes.
Mariano, who seemed like such a nice guy in the flashbacks, you know, very, very tenderhearted, caring, loyal, good guy.
Yeah.
I want to know how he makes the transition from, you know, ranch manager, trusted guy as a ranch hand, looking out for the family, to cartel kingpin. I really need to understand that transition, because when you see Mariano the first time, oh, look, hey, it's Mariano. Oh, fuck, it's Mariano. I need to understand that transition.
Yeah, it was definitely an odd, you know, because they like you said, they portray him as just this kind, like, caring, you know, he's like her bodyguard, but, you know, ranch hand, but he's become her bodyguard and cares for her. And then, but, you know, now he's like head of a drug cartel, like
cold-blooded.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I said, not everything's tying together quite yet. But again, you know, I mean, I enjoyed it enough. I will continue with the second season. That's more than I'll give Marshall's. You know, what I find interesting is I only saw the first two episodes of Marshall's. I have not seen any other episodes.
Yeah, you made it one episode further than I did, by the way.
But I believe the season finale of Marshall's ended with his son, Tate, being kidnapped.
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation online that Marshall's and Dutton Ranch will merge, that there'll be like a series crossover, like the Bionic Woman and the $6 Million Man back in the day, to address these various kidnappings in Texas.
Yeah. You know what I find? You know what I find most interesting, which would be interesting, you know, like the way to combine.
What, Paul?
I mean, not really, because I don't have to watch both. It's like when a comic book crosses over into another comic book you haven't been reading.
I don't remember. Is Taylor Sheridan doing any work on Marshall's? Because I know he's just name only on.
Yeah, okay. He's name only on both.
Okay. Okay.
What I find interesting, though, is
it might actually cross over.
Yeah, then it might actually cross over. Yeah. You know, but what I find interesting about Dutton Ranch is, you know, they're hinting at Mariano. You know, he's calling his papa, you know, in one scene, and I'm like, ooh, who's it going to be? Are they going to bring Andy Garcia in? Like, are we somehow going to tie this into Landman in Texas? Yeah. Like, how are we going to tie the, you know, like, who, what actor will they bring in? And it's fucking nobody. Yeah. You know, at least nobody that I know. And I'm like, that's how you know Taylor Sheridan isn't actually
What you need is Edward James Olmos.
Yes.
You know?
He'd be a little old for the role, because you probably just need someone in their 50s, but...
You need some gravitas.
Yes, you do. You do, but that role, they just brought in some, you know, generic Mexican guy. And I don't say that from a racist standpoint. They just, like, he's literally no one that's recognizable. It just feels like some guy they picked up off the street. And it's like, okay, you know, like, if you want this role to have the gravitas and for me to feel like this dude is bad, hire someone that, like, I know. Like that, when that first season of Landman ended, and Andy Garcia just pops up randomly, I'm like, holy shit. I was so blown away by it. And it's not like Andy Garcia is relevant anymore, but like for me, he's still relevant. So I was like so shocked by that reveal. And then for this reveal to be revealed to be like just some dude, like, I don't know, get the guy from Desperado, you know, or who was in the Fast and Furious movies, like get someone recognizable.
Oh, Antonio Banderas. There you go.
Antonio Banderas. Now that
he's the right age.
Ball.
He is the right age. And he's not doing anything.
No. He's not even married to Meg Ryan anymore. So, you know, anyway, that's besides the point. Is Dutton Ranch was okay. Big fat
it's
okay.
It's worth the watch, but boy, I've got some notes.
Yeah. Now I'm in that what's next time frame of viewing, because that's over. Widow's Bay is over.
You've got X-Men 97, Paul.
You know what? That's a good point. X-Men 97 has begun, and I have seen the of season two. I've seen the first two episodes. You know, much controversy about this show and its original showrunner, Bo DeMeo. You know, and he is responsible for much of the writing on the first season, and you know, a lot of the things that we liked about the first season. But very controversial. You know, it's a lot of he said she said on why he was fired from the show after the first season. Lots of, you know, apparently, you know, some of it's related to him having an OnlyFans page. Some of it, you know, but some people feel, or he feels.
Like a dirty OnlyFans page?
I believe so.
Huh.
I had not heard
any of this.
Yeah, like he has an OnlyFans page and people saying that's what, you know, that Disney hired, you know, fired him because of that. And, you know, he's saying Disney knew that and, you know, they fired him because they're not diverse, blah, 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 blah. Like, there's a lot of back and forth. We don't really know the reasons behind his firing. But that being said, because of the nature of animation, season two was largely already written and in production by the time of his firing. So his writing is still prevalent and is, you know, in season two. You know, so a lot of the story threads continue here from season one. But yeah, Bo DeMeo, look him up. He's very animated about his opinion about the whole thing.
Huh. Well, I'm gonna have to check out his OnlyFans page, of course.
that's where Aaron will go for the information.
What can I find out on OF?
Yeah. I feel like it's cheaper to just Google him, but you know,
OnlyFans. Hey, I'm just trying to help a guy out. He doesn't have a job, Paul.
This is true. This is true. And he's not helping himself by being so verbally anti-Disney, that because that goes for anybody. Just talk to the guy who was in the guy who played Finn in Force Awakens. How well it goes for your career to be anti-Disney.
Mm. So Wayne, I know that you've watched the first two episodes of X-Men 97. What do you think?
I love it. For me, as I'm sitting there watching the show, it reminds me of everything I used to love about X-Men comics. I'm not reading any X-Men comics right now, but it makes me want to go back to the 90s X-Men, because that's kind of my era of the book more than any other era. You know, there's some great 70s and 80s stuff too, but really the 90s was where I got into X-Men in particular the most. And this, it doesn't just feel like the original cartoon, because it feels like they realized, hey, our original viewers are now in their 30s, 40s, 50s, we need to up the death on this. We need to make it more violent. And so it is like a more mature version of the cartoon we used to watch.
Yeah.
Paul?
I think this season is off to a decent start. So, you know, this season has brought in, the X-Men have been transported across time to deal with Apocalypse in two timelines. Basically, in the far future, the time of the Akani, and Nate Summers, you know, pre-Cable Nate Summers, and then also the far past, ancient Egypt, when he's still El Sabanur, and you know, maybe kind of like, you know, killing Hitler in his crib kind of thing. And so, these two episodes largely dealt with the future time frame, where Forge and Cable have teamed up and have gotten Forge into the far future in order to bring the X-Men back to the present day. However, before they do, they have to help Nate Summers take down Apocalypse in the future. And so that's largely, you know, what happens in the first episode before we then get into a second episode, which is very much focused on the present day and X-Force. So Cable, Psylocke, Archangel, and for some reason Jubilee and
Sunspot
are X-Force, you know, taking on kind of Apocalypse's agents in the Four Horsemen in the present day. So we're kind of going back and forth in time. We've also got the introduction of X-Factor. You know, this is very much the X-Factor working for the government era of and X-Factor.
They were in the original cartoon series, too.
Okay, I don't remember, you know, like, but, you know, but I remember, but the thing is, you know, I read the Peter David, Joe Quesada, you know, X-Factor era of books, because that's the best era of X-Men.
Yeah, there were one or two episodes of the original cartoon where Iceman is looking for Polaris because they had been dating, and shows up, and they give a little bit of, you know, nod to the original X-Men team, and they do the introduction of X-Factor then. So it's they have been around at least once before, but it was interesting seeing them here and seeing Polaris. I don't want to give too much away since Aaron hasn't watched it yet.
You're not going to ruin anything for me. Go right ahead.
Okay.
Oh,
I super appreciated Jubilee being awesome.
Yeah, no, I did too. That second episode has some great, you know, some great Jubilee moments. But I want to pause here. Aaron, is he not ruining anything because you're out on X-Men 97?
I won't say I'm out. What I'll say is that it's not my bag. I am not a Cable guy. I really, really dislike Nate Summers. And I could just feel what this season was going to be. I should also say, 90s X-Men are really not my X-Men. I'm more of an 80s X-Men guy. I'm more of a Byrne Claremont guy versus the 90s run stuff. It's just not my bag. And I sat through that entire episode going, I don't care about any of this, you know?
And I get that because I will say that's the era of X-Men, even though it's introducing, you know, things from multiple eras of X-Men. You know, I will say that is the time of Nate Summers, which I guess was after Age of Apocalypse.
And see, I love Age of Apocalypse.
No, it was before Age of Apocalypse because I got into... I really got into X-Men comic-wise around the time of Executioner's Song.
Yeah, because I remember the virus. So it was 1994 is when, you know, you kind of had the whole Nate Summers. Just because I remember the series distinctly, The Adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix, which is when it was written by Scott Lobdell, and they were brought into the future, with their son and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think for me, I it was right around that time that I started moving away, I think, from X-Men, because that was after, which is crazy because that's 30 years ago. But, you know, it's kind of crazy to put it in perspective of, because, you know, like, obviously my main era of X-Men is the Jim Lee era, right? The Claremont era for sure. In fact, there was a whole Chris Claremont, and that was 1991. Was that era? You know, you had Wills Portacio on Uncanny X-Men, Jim Lee on X-Men.
The X-Men reboot with the brand new, all new number ones.
Yeah, the all new number ones. But
that is all part of my era. I came in though around Executioner's Song and Age of Apocalypse.
See, I feel like Executioner's Song is around the time I started wrapping up my X-Men lore, my X-Men love, because I feel like that's around the time a lot of these creators started jumping ship towards Image, right?
And I went back years later and I read all of the stuff leading up to it. So it's like, it definitely, I consider my era basically from X-Men number one, the relaunch, all the way up through Onslaught.
Okay.
And that's when I jumped off.
Yeah, because that's when things got to Heroes Reborn and all that stuff.
A Cable has such a Rob Liefeld quality to him, and I just can't bear it. The character design just bugs the tar out of me. It's that whole early Image stuff that bugs me.
Yeah, and you know what's funny to me, and I don't know what it was inspired by, but since we've last podcasted, I actually got in the mood to revisit some of that early Image stuff. You know, like the you know, because again, a lot of these creators basically went to Image and just kind of, you know, did the same thing just with different characters. And right. So I was in the mood for like, I'm going to read Extreme Prejudice from Image Comics. You know, the crossover in that whole Youngblood universe with Brigade and Bloodstrike and Supreme and Team Youngblood. And, you know, just I was like, I'm kind of in the mood to like revisit some of those cheesy late, you know, late 90s stories. And none of that stuff is available digitally.
Yeah.
And that,
you know, the advantage going back to some of that now is now you know what actually worked and what didn't. Because at the time, they were flooding the market with style over substance and a lot of books that were just terrible books, but they looked pretty.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, the one I really wanted to revisit was Extreme Sacrifice, which was, you know, I don't know if you guys remember Stephen Platt on Prophet. And it was the one where Chapel had been killed and was in hell and had taken over as, you know, as basically the devil. And they had, you know, like Newman, like one of the characters had just had a baby. Like, I just, like, it was like, this was the late 90s. This was my, like, it was mid 90s, 1995. And this was like, you know, like these things that I remembered. And, but again, none of it's available digitally, which makes me very sad because I would have loved to have read it this week. But anyway, I've kind of gotten off on a tangent, but X-Men 97 is very much like skirting on the end of my X-Men attention span as it relates to the comics. But still, you know, I did very much enjoy these first two episodes. I find that I have Apocalypse issues in general when it comes to X-Men. Like, I love some Apocalypse stuff. Like, the mm-hmm. Apocalypse stuff in the... most recent, I shouldn't say, but the, I don't know if you guys remember, there was an X-Force reboot a few years back that was, you know, like the characters were all in like black costumes, and I feel like
Wolverine and Deadpool.
Yeah, it was Uncanny X-Force. It was written by Rick Remender with art by Jerome O'Quinn. I loved that book.
It was a good book. I think I only read the first four on that one, but I recall enjoying it.
Yeah, I also just looked it up, and it was in October 2010. That book was 16 years old. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, that hurts. But yeah, I loved, absolutely adored that book. But you know, in general, I think Apocalypse is a character kind of like Mr. Sinister that's gotten so overly complicated with so many different iterations of him, and you've got El Salvador and the weird continuity, and it doesn't all tie together and doesn't all make sense, that I've kind of just lost interest at some point.
Yeah. So Apocalypse is by far my favorite X-Men villain.
Really?
I love the character. I always have, until the recent years, basically when they did Krakoa and they start making him, like, suddenly he's a good guy with the X-Men. And
oh, is that the baby? No. Not baby. Like, yeah, because that's the little kid, right? Isn't that the kid that they... Because that was the whole point of Uncanny X-Force, is Apocalypse had been reborn as a child, and they were... And it was about, basically... And is that it's that child that has now grown up into the Apocalypse that's, quote-unquote, good now.
I think you're talking about baby Thanos.
No, there's a baby Apocalypse.
There was a baby Apocalypse. He was
Apocalypse, and also, but a child. Baby Darkseid. I think you're talking about that too. So
yeah, you know, it's comics. It could be any number of characters, really.
Yeah, no, Apocalypse has always been my favorite, starting with The Fall of the Mutants.
He was my favorite. But yeah, then, really? Again, I think it got a little convoluted. But yeah, I mean, of course, in the end, it's always going to be Magneto.
I straight up disliked Apocalypse from X-Factor on. Like the original X-Factor with the Walt Simonson pencils.
Oh, and I loved him. I loved the ship that they get from him. And
hate that guy.
Who was your favorite, Aaron? Was it Strife?
No. My favorite
Strife is nobody's favorite.
Arcade?
There is a character that I've only seen once in the X-Men books. His name was, I want to say it was Proteus. And he was Moira MacTaggert's mutant son.
Yes.
And I absolutely loved him. He was so evil. And I love the way he was drawn. It was John Byrne and Terry Austin drawing that character, and I've just always loved that guy. And I've never seen him since. You know, they quote kill him off in that book. I think he's been back once or twice, but I've not seen him in a book since then.
Yeah, they've definitely brought him back a bunch. I've seen him mostly in alternate versions. Like, they had a version of him in the... Do you remember the Marvel book Exiles?
I remember the book. I've never read it.
A group of X-Men-style characters that are jumping from universe to universe trying to fix the multiverse because their universe doesn't exist anymore. They go into a world with Proteus, where he has basically taken over the world.
Hmm. You know, it's funny because
we're deviating far from X-Men 97.
But, you know, yeah. I think part of it is that X-Men, you know, I think you can tell, like, one of the reasons I don't read X-Men is because they always overly complicate it.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I always hop out. When it's narrow, I'm there. But when it starts fanning out, crossovers, events, new books, suddenly, you know, if you're following a storyline and you've got to follow six different titles, I'm out.
Well, and that's the thing. I have that same issue of when there's a lot of titles. But one of the things I love about X-Men is how complicated it is. For at least the 90s period, it felt like they were remembering every bit of continuity. Things were building. You would get secrets that would take sometimes a decade to reveal. And I appreciate that because it felt like you were being rewarded for being a longtime reader.
And well, that's the kind of thing I get from the cartoon. Right. Yeah, and that's one thing I say. I don't mind continuity. I mind, you know, eight different ongoing series, multiple limited series, you know, crossovers every 3 months that require you to buy every book.
Yep.
You know, that's where they lose me a little bit. But, like, I would love to go back to the days of just giving, like, three or four core X-Men books. But, you know, even then, they did try that recently, you know, they did recently have another relaunch written by Jed McKay, who I'm actually a fan of, and it didn't connect with me. So it's just one of those titles that I always want to, you know, I want to keep trying, but...
I jumped on when they did the relaunch really hoping that it would get me, and it didn't. I just want two final things about the series, and it seems like episode 2 has far more memorable for me than episode 1, which Aaron will dislike because there's so much more cable. But... The very first thing I enjoyed about it was they changed the front. So, like, when the show starts, they start with the X-Men music and all of the, you know, basically the 90s intro for the regular series. Episode 2, instead of X-Men, it says X-Force, and they have a whole new cartoon beginning to it, but the same song. The other moment was more because I'm watching this with my wife, and at the point X-Factor shows up, she takes one look at the group and says, "Who's the Cyclops ripoff?" And then moments later, Jubilee makes the comment to Havoc of calling him budget Cyclops.
That's funny.
So I got a kick out of that moment. But I mean, I'm definitely on board because this is bringing back all of my 90s X-Men nostalgia, and that's my era of X-Men. So
yeah, agree.
I'm loving it. It's making me want to read old comics.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the series. I look forward to continuing with it.
X-Men is one of those books that I feel like they need, you know, have all your multiple X-Men titles and crossovers and all that, but I really feel like there ought to be a book that's just kind of core, this is it. And it's kind of like they did on that, what was that, X-Men 95 that they published? Was that it?
94, I think maybe.
94, whatever it was. But, you know, they X-Men had
Forever, sort of a, maybe.
Oh, X-Men Forever. Yeah. That's exactly what it was. And I think that's the way to go so that you can tell an X-Men story that doesn't need to fan out. You can, you know, get Aaron's dollars for that book. And I'm sure that there are a number of folks like me who just like, I can't digest multiple books of X-Men. Like, for instance, I know Wayne hated the Krakoa books. Yes. I liked them. It was too many damn books. Yeah. And, you know, even trying to go and pick them up when they're on sale, I can't figure out reading. I have to go to a separate webpage to figure out the fucking reading order on this stuff, you know, because the books don't help you out. You know
what's funny? We're basically referring to an Ultimate X-Men book. Like, just give me an Ultimate X-Men book, but one that's actually good.
Yeah, you know? Because there has never been a good Ultimate X-Men book.
Oh, and I stand by. I like that. The first. No. The original iteration, I really liked. The one with the Adam Kubert. Yeah, no.
All it terrible. Started really good. It just went it off fell the rails.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I will say the latest relaunch, Aaron, did a lot of like what you're describing of what you want, except each individual book, they were not crossing over.
Mm-hmm.
Each one was for a different type of X-Men reader. One was for the readers that want to see the new younger mutants being trained. One was for the, I want big action fighting. And like they had a different goal for each book. Each team was completely separate, not crossing over. Naturally, that all went away and they started crossing over, though.
Yeah. And that's the problem is that, you know, they'll start off, this is core, and then, you know, crossovers. And you got to buy the other shit. I need something where they come out and say, this will never cross over. This is going to be its own thing.
Yeah. So. Well, and so, I'm curious how we're, you know, that new Midnight relaunch that's coming later this year in October.
It does look interesting, I got to say.
It's going to reimagine, X-Men, Spider-Man, and Fantastic Four. You know, maybe that's one that'll get me intrigued in this era of X-Men. So we'll see.
Yeah.
But, and what's interesting about that one is that it reimagines kind of this X-Men lore that involves heavy emphasis on vampires, which it's kind of funny because this is a very vampire heavy week. We had two new vampire books come out this week, two new independent-ish vampire books. I think one was from Boom, one was from IDW, maybe. We had Vampirates and Operation Iron Coffin. And so Vampirates has reimagined, history where, we've kind of got this pirate empire led by vampirates, and Operation Iron Coffin is set during the ages of World War II, where Dracula is seeking redemption to save his soul. And by doing so, he has to take out every remaining vampire, and that involves killing some Nazis. And so that's the two very different premises, two very, very different books. And I have two very different opinions on that.
I only read one of the two, so.
I hated, from cover to cover, Vampirates.
Same. Well, I can't say cover to cover because I didn't make it that far. I sat down I was so three sad different about times. It. Yeah.
I was so I wanted sad to like about it. This book.
Yeah, I thought, number one... Go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, at its core, Vampire Pirate seems like an easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it even has Fred Van Lente is the writer on this book.
It's the reason why I picked it up.
Yeah, exactly. But ultimately, it's like, it's not, I wouldn't even call it a vampire pirate book. It basically just feels like a fantasy book, featuring vampires as the main characters. Because the piracy of it literally has almost nothing to do with this book. It could be Vampire Game of Thrones, for all it's worth. And so unfortunately, like, the concept of it, vampire pirates, or even if it was just pirates versus vampires, was what sold me. But that is not the book that I read. The book that I read was, a fantasy book featuring vampires and boats. Mm-hmm. Not until the last page, really. I really disliked this book. I was so bored with it. I was so bored with the concept of it and the idea of it and the language and just, I was like, oh, this is terrible. There was nothing enjoyable about that book for me.
I tried three different times to read this book. I kept going, it's me. I'm just not in the mood for this, whatever this is. And I got to tell you, on my third sitting, I'm like, nope, it's the book. I did not respond to the artwork, did not respond to the writing, the pacing, any of it. I was just like, this is not good. This is not something I don't know who this is written for, but it was not written for me.
Yeah. Nope. Agreed.
So,
yeah. On the flip, I wouldn't say on the total flip side, but the other book was Operation Iron Coffin, which, has a much more outrageous, I would say almost manga inspired art style. And Wayne, I'm curious for your thoughts about that one.
Okay. So my very first thought was, recently, I had played a role-playing game called Aetherreich, where you are vampires that have been recruited to be dropped in and fighting Nazis. And the very first thing that happens in the game typically is you in your iron coffins are dropped from a plane into, you know, Nazi territory. So when this book starts, I immediately am getting flashbacks to this game, because it starts with Dracula in a coffin that looks to be like an iron coffin dropped from a plane onto this train. I love the book. There were some things I didn't care for. Some of it was with the art that they were using. I kind of wanted a Dracula that was doing more, I don't know, ripping people's throats out with his teeth and things versus having his fingers slice people's heads off. And I know it's supposed to be claws, but it's like, based on the art, for a lot of them, it's like the side of his fingers are sharp and slicing people's heads off, and his fingers are growing into claws. And
yeah, I agree. I think for me, the issue that I had with the book was the art. I think the concept was fun. I think the story, but the actual art of it, I found it didn't connect to me. I felt it was almost a little too stylish. And silly for the story that they were telling. So I enjoyed the book, but fun concept, even the idea of it, you know, the story that they're setting up, because this is basically, you know, a fast speed train, you know, Dracula's on this train trying to, you know, stop these zombies, but they have control over some, it's not zombies, Nazis, but they have control over some other vampires. So, you know, you've got some vampire on vampire fighting and some,
well, not,
you know,
only that, it's also all of the paranormal Nazis are on board the train. So you get a car full of normal Nazis, and then you get a Nazi who's carrying the Spear of Destiny. That he,
I was
going to
say, you get Spear of Destiny, you know.
My favorite section of the book, though, and I think the artwork didn't take away from this as much as it did other areas, was right after they do a whole flashback scene where he remembers being killed and going into purgatory and being offered a deal to come back to avoid going to hell. And so the Dracula that we get in this book is a Dracula that has had his soul given back to him. And the very first thing he runs across is a mother who got turned and doesn't understand that she has just killed her children. And she has her bleeding children in her arms trying to figure out why they won't wake up. And it just, that was heart-wrenching. And I thought it was done so well. And the art actually didn't take away from it too much until time for him to kill her.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I will say, for what it's worth, as much as I enjoyed the book, I don't know that I'll continue with it just because of the art, though.
I am definitely continuing because I was enjoying the story so much. And unlike the other books I read this week, this one lasted. I mean, it's 44 pages, so that's why. It felt like everything else I read this week was just a couple pages and done. And this one, the story just kept going.
Okay, well... Yeah, I mean, you'll have to keep me updated, and I will let you be the canary in the coal mine on the second issue, and you just let
so
me
you're know. Out. You're out. I think I'm out on Coffin. This one. I thought for sure you were going to give me a recommendation to pick up Iron Coffin.
And I get exactly why he's out too, because the art really does hinder the story. The story is so good, and the art is. And they wanted to go high gore, but it's kind of like I said. At times, he's cutting people's heads off with the side of his pinky. It bothered me.
Yeah. So, I mean, so for that, I think I'm out. But again, Wayne, if the second issue is just as good, is good, let me know. I could be easily convinced. I'm on the fence is probably a way of saying it. You know, and we're not even going to hit anything from the big two today, because the only other book we want to talk about today is Exquisite Corpses, Rascal Randy, number one, a prequel to the Exquisite Corpses series, focused on the character of Rascal Randy and his origin, we think. I don't know if it's his origin or if it's just a story set before, because, you know, there's a lot of characters in this book, and there is someone dressed as Rascal Randy. We don't know if it's the same one that we experience in Exquisite Corpses, but, you know, we've kind of got... Yeah, he does kill someone. So this book is very much more like... a little less like Exquisite Corpses, more like a slasher movie vibe to it.
And I think it's important to note that this is not written by James Tynion IV. It's written by Tyler Boss with art by Dylan Burnett. The three prequel books that are coming out at post Exquisite Corpses are all done by other talent. So I think this is a big step in the broadening of the Exquisite Corpses universe by having other creators involved. I think it's a really interesting choice to do this soon. And I'm sure it was a function of, you know, my God, we want to, you know, jump on the popularity of the book soon. And the way to do that was to have other creators come in and do it. But it's really interesting to me that they're already doing this, bringing in other people to work on the book. And I got to say, go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I'm actually okay with it. Cause I think for me, one, you know, I'm not familiar with Tyler Boss, but you know, the other books are written by Che Grayson and Pornsack Pistachio.
Yeah.
And we like those authors.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like they've got good quality creative teams on these books. And, you know, I think I'm okay with James Tynion focusing on the main book, and it's expanding this universe in a way that they've kind of always hinted at from the beginning, right? It's this card game, but it's also this comic, this TV series, and we've got these other stories we want to tell within the same universe. It makes Exquisite Corpses feel almost like its own universe rather than just one book. As long as they don't overcomplicate it like the X-Men, I'm okay with it.
Well, and I gotta say, I thought it did well at kind of keeping the same tone and texture of Exquisite Corpses. You know, the art's very different, but the tone is the same. I thought that was well done. But Paul, are you familiar with Scott McCloud?
Yeah.
You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, the Understanding Comics guy?
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah.
Eli, the character Eli, feels of Scott McCloud.
Really, I mean, does.
I kept going back to the title page on the book or the credits page of the book just to see if Scott McCloud had any involvement in it, because it was cracking me up how very much it looks like the way Scott McCloud draws himself in Understanding Comics.
So, that's a good point. I actually really enjoyed this book. I thought
same
it was
here.
There's nothing new about it. It's like I said, it's a slasher movie, but I enjoyed the characters. I enjoyed that we've kind of established that Rascal Randy is
a pop culture character.
He's a pop culture character, like a Barney type character.
Yeah. Yeah. With video games, Funko Pops, the whole bit.
I'm a little more torn on the book than you guys. I like the characters quite a bit, and I was expecting one of these two characters to eventually be Rascal Randy, but there seems to be a Rascal Randy out there killing people already. And if it is the kid, I just don't buy it. I don't buy that this weak, diabetic kid is in a place yet where he could be killing someone that is his muscular bully. So
you know what I would say? I don't believe it's the kid. I think if I think we're going to see two things here. This is my premonition. We'll see if I'm wrong. I believe the current Rascal Randy is probably his aunt.
I agree.
Killing kids that pick on her son. I believe the Rascal Randy we see in Exquisite Corpses is sometime later and is this kid grown up. Because there's no real time established in here, right? Like, there's no use of cell phones. If anything, it kind of feels like it could be a little bit back in time because of, you know, you've got the roller skating rink, you've got the arcades, you know, you've kind of got settings that are a little bit more, you know, maybe 90s-esque. So
there is a great big HD flat screen TV in their living room. So I think
fair point.
Could be early 2000s.
Yeah. Could be early 2000s. I am personally hoping they do a twist and the person who actually becomes Rascal Randy will be Lily, not
yeah,
the
maybe.
Boy.
I mean, I think it'll be one of them is the one we meet in Exquisite Corpses. That would be my guess. The actual, you know, main series. But yeah, I don't know. But I like what it's setting up. But I'm sorry, Wayne, you were saying that, you know, you're kind of torn on it.
Yeah, and that was my thing, is they're making us like these characters that one of them will likely be eventually ripped apart, mentally destroyed to become a character like that. So we're going to see characters we like have horrible things happen to them. I'm on board for it. I'm going to read the next issue still, but
what horror is, Wayne. You take these characters and you do horrible things to them. These characters you care about.
Yeah, and
that's why you don't like horror.
No, I actually like these characters, and usually I don't like characters in horror movies or books, and so I don't mind having horrible things happen to them. Well, but yeah, I do agree. If neither one of these could be currently the Rascal Randy, and I think there will be a new Rascal Randy by the end of the book.
So I'm in. Mm-hmm. I'm in. I'm looking forward to Fox Mask Killer, and I'm looking forward to Lone Gunman.
Yeah, I know. I really liked this book. I very much enjoyed it. I'm curious to see where it goes. And I thought that the creative team was well chosen. So I like it.
Agreed. So,
hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
What's coming out next week?
Well, next week from DC Comics, we have Dark Knights of Steel 2, the sequel to the original Dark Knights of Steel with Tom Taylor returning to write. You know, this was the DC universe set in medieval times. I think we enjoyed the first series. I don't honestly remember how it wrapped up. But the sequel is due out starting next week.
So, also Paul, I think we may have not finished it because we loved the series as it was going, and then suddenly it took a break, and they had like a couple of one-shots in there, and then they came back and finished it.
I feel like I did finally finish reading it, though. I don't know. I guess I have to revisit it.
But it lost the momentum for us at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do remember the break now that you mention it. So, I don't know. We'll see. But what I am excited about is that Absolute Green Arrow issue 3 comes out. We actually did not talk about issue 2, but we quite enjoyed issue 1. So the third issue of Absolute Green Arrow also comes out from DC Comics. From Marvel Comics, we have the second issue of Avengers Armageddon, which is the final reckoning that leads to a major shakeup for the Avengers. So this is the Thunderbolt Ross has taken over Latveria, and the Avengers, well, he's calling it New America, I believe. And the Avengers
I'm really enjoying Avengers Armageddon, so I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, so we'll definitely talk about that next week.
I think it's the only thing worth reading right now over at Marvel, so there you go.
You're probably not wrong. Well, and Wayne, for you, my dearest friend, Sonic the Hedgehog versus Godzilla from IDW comes out next week. Well, it's not versus. It's Sonic the Hedgehog X Godzilla comes out next week.
No. So
that's it. No.
Very good.
I will say, there's a book I'm interested in that I've seen advertised. I saw it advertised in a couple of books that I picked up this week, The Horror of Godzilla, which is a terrifying look at Godzilla's first attack, done very much in like the style of, a horror movie. It's a ground level view of the kaiju's first attack. It seems interesting. I've seen the ad in a couple of books written by Ethan Parker, who I'm not quite familiar with, but I may check that out. But that's not next week. That's later on in July.
No. One book that's coming out next week that I plan on picking up, the recent What Ifs have actually been good for a change.
I would agree. I read the What If Thor Got the Venom Suit, and that was fantastic.
So next week is What If Jessica Jones, where she gets bitten by Spider-Man's radioactive spider.
Interesting.
So
interesting.
I'm going to give it a try, because like I said, I was really happy with the What If Secret Wars from a week or so ago.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, by and large, I'm not enjoying much of what Marvel's putting out these days.
Yeah, same. I'm looking forward to the Midnight thing.
Yeah. Well, hey, we want to know what books you're not reading at Marvel, and you know, maybe what books you enjoyed this week from the other publishers. Give us a shout at ideologyofmadness@gmail.com, and if we use your comments on the show, you could win a coveted, valuable Ideology of Madness surprise.
You can also hit us up on social media, IOMGeek, on Facebook, Instagram, and X.
What a deal. Well, hey, guys, I'm hoping that next week we find that Wayne has indeed brought Andrew to justice, and we'll go from there.
And by justice, you mean back to the show?
Well, I mean, that is a suitable punishment. So
that's what I was
for our listeners.
Yeah. Talk to you next week, guys.
Gotcha then.
Podcast theme music graciously provided by Mark Andrew Pope. For more information, visit markandrewpope.com. Funny Books with Aaron and Polly is a production of ideologyofmadness.com. No Spider-Man clones were harmed in the production of this podcast.